Thank you, brother, for your prayer and all of your prayers. It's amazing to watch God work in our weakness and in our humanity to be able to come together and share from his word. And I trust all learn together. Visions of a Godly Family. Today, the title of the message is The Expectations of a Godly Home. So on our first day there, with the eternity that's in a godly home, I trust that all of us somehow are able to get a vision that includes the knowing of God and the preparation place for a greater future work. Just a vision. Homes aren't just there for our own little cozy place to live. There's a greater vision. It's an eternal vision. And I trust that yesterday, as we talked about getting pickled in the environment of our home, that there's a little bit of an urge to make the environment of our home that we would all be steeped. It's another term we use, is steeped in godliness. That our homes are a place where we are steeped in godliness, where we're soaking in that. To where when we come out of that, that is obviously what we are. Some people would say to the message that I shared yesterday on the environment and the pickle jar there, they would say, well, what you're talking about is brainwashing these young people, and that ought not so to be. And I disagree strongly with that. I think we should be brainwashing our young people. I think we should be heartwashing our young people. I think we should be helping them come up in an environment where they automatically think godly thoughts and in a godly way and in a godly perspective. I find no fault in that. I would find fault in the opposite of that quite strongly. If it's brainwashing, if it's hard work, habit shaping, perspective shaping, whatever you want to call it, that's what happens in the environment of a godly home, and we're thankful for that. And we need more of them. We need more of them, and right here is the seed for several more. We're thankful for that. Thankful for each one of you young people. So today we move into the expectations of a godly home, and this has possibly a little more of a practical direction to it. I don't intend for you young families back there, I don't intend to just tell you how to raise your children in an everyday way necessarily, but hopefully there's a few nuggets you can pick up along the way here. There's not enough time in one message to tell you how to spank your child for each circumstance that comes up. There's too many situations that are unknown and too many situations, but hopefully there can be a principles that you can grasp here and move forward with. It's expectations. By that I simply mean it's a desired daily pattern of living. A desired daily pattern of living. And this expectation, there's something that's expected to happen. There's some things that are expected to happen in a godly home. We're just expected to. We get it from the Word. We get it from history and observation of successes and failures. There's an expectation of things that will be happening there in this daily pattern of living. It's part of the plan to produce a godly heritage. Another term for it is life patterning. Life patterning. If you turn to Genesis chapter 18, it's a favorite of mine when I think about this whole subject of training up children, and I hear it often and I feel it myself tremendously, and that is just simply the lack of qualification for this great project, this great thing. It's like, Lord, you've entrusted something so eternal to me and to us, something so precious, something so valuable, something that has so much potential, eternal potential, generational potential, and here it is, and I'm so unqualified. And yet then I look at this verse here in Genesis chapter 18, verse 19. And this is where God says of Abraham, and as he was looking for somebody to raise the promised seed and somebody to commit the covenant to, that there would be a promised seed that was promised from the beginning. He looked to Abraham, and he found Abraham, and you know where he found Abraham? He found Abraham down there living in a household. This is going to go against everything that I'm teaching all week, but I'm going to say it anyway, because God can do mighty things. He found Abraham living in a household whose daddy was an idol worshiper. Whose daddy not only was an idol worshiper, he made idols. That was his occupation. He carved out idols or molded them or whatever he did, and he sold them. That was his occupation. This is where Abraham lived, down in a heathen land, Ur of the Chaldees. And God said to Abraham, he said, Abraham, and what was he, 75 years old or something like that? And he come and he said, Abraham, and he saw something in this man raised in that environment that was so far from perfect, but he saw a faithfulness, he saw a desire, he saw a hunger, he saw a potential. He said, Abraham, get you up, get you out of your father's house. We're going to move. You're going to move. You're going to move from everything you've ever known, all the comfort zones you've ever had, all of the normals in your life, everything that's secure to you. We're going to take you out of that, and we're going to move, and we're going to get you a new place to live. And don't worry about that, where that's going to be. I'll show you where that is later on. I'll tell you about that later, but let's go. And I was just sharing with a brother about that. That's why it's fresh on my mind, I guess. And his dear wife, can you imagine? A beautiful Sarah, she was probably a model. She probably could have won beauty contests, at least in Abraham's eyes. Scripture calls her very fair to look upon. Probably had all kinds of potential in that land. And he had the leadership qualities and the strength and confidence and security to be able to tell Sarah, this is what we're going to do. And she followed after him. She trusted him. She knew that all would be well with the spirit of her husband as he was. But here was Abraham. Out of a less than perfect environment, God saw something. And God said this about him. I was looking for him, and I saw him. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham? And this is breaking right into the middle of his conversation there. But I just want this one verse. For I know Abraham. I back up to verse 18. Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him, for I know him that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. God looked on Abraham and he saw a man that he says, I know him, and he knows you, and he knows you, and he knows all of us. He knows you. But he said of Abraham, I know that there's an expectation that I can expect out of Abraham's life. And what did he say? I know that he will command his children after him, and that his children shall keep the way of the Lord, and that they will do justice, and they will do judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he had spoken of him. He was expecting something out of a household in this lineage that he was about to begin, this lineage where he had begun it already, but he was covenanting with Abraham and expanding this promised seed lineage. These are some things he wanted. He wanted them to keep the way of the Lord. He wanted them to do justice and judgment. He wanted them to be performing his will. And he said, I know Abraham. His household is going to be such and such that when they are living their life, it's going to produce that expected end. And that's what he wants from each one of us. He wants an expectation to come out of our homes. It's not just neither here nor there. It's not just, well, whatever happens, happens. It's not just, well, if we get fortunate and our children happen to have the right kind of attitude and spirit and they turn out, well, that's wonderful. There's an expectation. There's an end that God desires, and that's what we want to promote today. Abraham was qualified. I believe you're all qualified. Remember what Abraham said, or what happened to Abraham there in Genesis chapter 22, when God said, Abraham, I got something else I want you to do. By this time, Abraham still didn't have that land that he thought he was going to find. He still didn't have the nice house maybe he imagined he was going to build when he left Ur of the Chaldees. He still didn't have everything plotted out in nice little pastures and farmlands, and you know, his little empire still wasn't there. When God said something else, he says, Abraham, take your son, your only son Isaac, and let's go up here on the mountain and let's sacrifice him. I'm not sure if he told him right then what he was going to. I think he did. And Abraham just said immediately, he got up the next morning, saddled his ass, and away he went. This is the Abraham that God knew. Something about him, immediate obedience. Something about him, his will was not his own. His will was gone. Something about him, God could trust. Deuteronomy 6 is another chapter we often and almost always go to when we think about the raising of children, but it's worthy of reading frequently as we think about our own lives and how this applies to us, because it impresses on us the full-time job. That's how I'd like to say it. It impresses on us the full-time job. This is not just a side project. When we're in the stage of life where we have young people, children, little children, young people in our homes, this is not just a project that we're doing kind of over here on the side, maybe after hours. This is a full-time job. And Deuteronomy impresses that on us. Just read these quickly, starting in verse 3. Hear therefore, O Israel, and observe to do it, that it may be well with thee, that ye may increase mightily, as the Lord God of thy fathers has promised thee, in the land that floweth with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. Thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. Thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. And it shall be, when the Lord thy God shall have brought thee into the land which thy fathers, which he sware unto thy fathers. And then it goes on from there. We need to stop with that. There's other verses that are coming to mind, but I'm just going to move on here. But you understand the picture here. God says, this is how you raise up children. This is how you train a godly seed after you. It's when you go in. It's when you come out. It's when you get up. It's when you sit down. It's when you do this and when you do that. And in every activity, in every pastime, in every responsibility, in everything that happens, teach, 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 teach. Tell, tell, tell. Think about it, fathers and mothers. Think about the opportunities and hours that you have to spend with these children. And you can just, you have a decision to make. You can silently work through the day and just do your thing. Or you can say, well, look at that. Here's a little lesson I can teach. And we're all gifted in different ways in that way. But look for those opportunities. It's all the time, all day long. And it's not all just about that spanking that needs to happen periodically in a child's life. Like, we're going to talk about that a little bit. But it's not all about the rod. There's teaching, 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 interacting, interacting. And I think that's what he's talking about. And he said it's going to take diligence. So let's not forget that. He never suggests anywhere that this is going to be some relaxing thing that just sort of comes natural. He says diligently, thou shalt teach them diligently. So there's diligence. So there's Deuteronomy 6 for us. It's a way of life. It's a period of life, but it's a way of life during that period of life. And never look at it as a side project. Never look at it as, I remember, I'm just going to confess something here. I remember when we first started having children, and some of you were there, and the realization began to dawn on us that we have one, and now it's two, and they're all little, and then there's a third one, and they have so many needs, and there's dirty diapers, and some oftentimes two of them in diapers at the same times, and maybe doing, you know, there's crying, and there's needs being, and I remember we had this conversation. I'm sorry about this, but it's almost humorous to me now. We had this conversation, won't it be nice when these children all grow up, get married, and it's just the two of us again? Very selfish conversation, terrible. But we had that conversation. And today, I look at those days and those were some very sweet times. And they still are, but today as the children began to leave home and they're getting married, we wonder, how are we going to get along when it's just the two of us? Life has been so rich and it's been so sweet and it's been such a blessing. And so those cherish those times and don't have thoughts like we had there. They're going to be gone in just a flash. Just cherish those times, cherish those moments. It is a way of life. But when we adapt to it as a way of life rather than something to be endured or just a project that we got to get done, and when it's done, why won't that be a restful time when that project? No, it's a way of life. Accept it as that, and it's God's way of life. And he's looking for people who want to diligently do that so that there is an expected end for these young children. Sometimes this life patterning that we often refer to as child training, sometimes this life patterning is like that hidden path that we talked about on the first day when we're here and we see the end and we don't know everything that's going on between there. I'm just going to acknowledge that. There are those stumbling stones on the path that we don't see between us and the desired end. There are those fallen trees across the path that we can't see because of the canopy of the trees between us and the desire. It's like that valley between, so to speak. There's times it's like that. It can be a challenge. And I just want to share all that because I don't want to minimize it and stand up here because I'm not in the thick of it anymore and just act like that was just the most wonderful, most tremendous, most easy, most blessed, most sweet time there ever was. Because it is real. It is very real. But the reason I share that is the goal is still there. The goal is still there. And there's an expectation that when we arrive at that goal, here's going to be godly children who have godly homes. The goal that we all have, I think, as families, is that our children would have a godly home. And that our grandchildren, we're going to talk about that tomorrow. But move on here. It's like the hidden path between. Also, this thing of life patterning for children sometimes becomes a time of parent patterning as well. I was just sharing with a brother here a minutes before we stood up here, and he was talking about working with the will of his child, and suddenly realized that the opportunity to work with the will of his child had a reciprocal effect, and his own will was exposed, and it was an opportunity to work in his own will as well. And I can testify to the same thing many, many times. It's also an opportunity God is giving us to pattern our lives as adults. So I want to talk about three areas today, just three areas in this expectation of a godly home. It's just three areas, and then we could probably come up with a lot more, but three areas that the Lord brought to my mind here, here they are. One is an orderly life. That's one area. The second one is the will problem. And the third one is the reason for rules. An orderly life, the will problem, and the reason for rules. Three little sections. Remember, this is a vision for a godly family. We're trying to get somewhere. We're going somewhere with this. It's purposeful. Conversation with my wife spawned a thought or two here this morning early. Or no, it was last night, I guess, in bed. I just say this to young people, to you youth, you young people, and to young parents, very young parents. Just want to say this. Set your goals high. Set them way up there. Set them almost out of reach. Now, I remember, was it just yesterday, that I said sometimes we get a little discouraged because we look around and we see people whose homes almost vibrate with the spirituality that we think they do anyway. And we get a little jealous and discouraged because of that. But I'm still telling you, set your goals high. Set them where you almost can't reach. I remember on the high jump, as a young boy, I don't know, I was probably too focused on fitness myself, but I love to run and I love to jump high. And so one of the things I would do is I would go out there and take those sticks and nail them together and make me these little stands, and I'd put a piece of pipe that I could drag out of the back of the barn and put on those little nails that I would put every 2 inches apart. And then I would take off running and I'd jump over that pipe. And you know what I did? You know where the pipe spent most of its time? On the ground, of course, but it didn't stay on that first nail or the second or the third. It stayed on that one I just almost could jump over. That's where I kept it because I knew I wanted to jump over that one. As soon as I cleared that one time, I'd move it up to the next one. That's how I did. And that's how professional athletes do too, I guess. But I'm not saying that's what we need to go home and focus on our fitness, but that's what I did and that's what I want us to do. Keep it up there high. Keep it high. And here's why. It is not common for people to raise the standard higher after they fought the battle for a while. It's more common for it to deteriorate a little bit. And I'm not saying that's good, but it's more common. So if we start down here, we think, well, I'll just make it where I can reach. I'll just make it where I can reach. And then you start having these little children, and you have one, two, three of those things, and the challenges of life. It's rare that you're going to set the standard higher. You can do it by the grace of God. He brings revival. He wakes us up. But I'd say start high. Start high. A brother we used to live in the community with loved to go on mountain hikes. And he liked to take his children and they would backpack into the mountains in the northwest here. And they would backpack up to, and there was one certain place they liked to go to, and it was a hidden lake. I don't remember the name of the lake, but it was a hidden lake. I remember maybe that was its name, Hidden Lake. I'm not sure. Anyway, they would put on their backpacks, and they would be hiking along, and he would be there, and his children would be three of them. They would be younger and youngest, and they had their little packs too, and they would be going along, and pretty soon he had two packs on because the littlest one no longer had a pack on, and they would keep on going up this mountain, and they'd be getting more and more weary, and they'd be getting tired, but they wanted to get to that hidden lake. That's where they wanted to camp, and it wouldn't be long. They'd be about halfway there, and now he'd have three packs on because the second one got tired out and couldn't carry his pack anymore, or her pack, and away they would go, and they'd keep on going. Dad, how long, how much farther is it? How much farther are we going to get there? And they'd get about three-fourths of the way. Now he had three packs on, and he was carrying the littlest one, and I'm probably stretching the story a bit, but that's kind of how he tells it. And they would just keep on going, and they'd get maybe 7/8 of the way, and it'd be like, Dad, couldn't we just stop and camp right here? Just camp right here. Well, he said, I'm pretty sure it's just over the next rise. We're getting real close. And they'd get over the next rise and still wouldn't be there. Well, Dad, can't we just camp right here? We're so tired. But he knew that everybody wanted to get to Hidden Lake. There was fish in the lake. They were going to spend a day or two there. It was going to be nice and peaceful and beautiful. That's where they wanted to get to. Their goal was set high, but the temptation was to stop here. And then we press on. Well, that's why we set our goal high. It wouldn't have been wrong for them to stop half a mile from the lake and camp there. I'm sure there was trees and rocks and things to look at, but that's not where they wanted to go. I have a son right now who's working on a house, and the tendency of this boy is, this young man, is to set his goals very, very high. And sometimes dad gets a little humor because it's a lot like I was when I was in my 20s as well. But he's trying to get this house ready for him and his fiance, thank you, for him and his fiance to live in. And he's excited about that. He's excited about marriage. He's excited about living in this place. And there's a certain amount of work he wants to get done so that it's nice for his bride and a good place to live. And so he barely got the house closed, and he was tearing out walls. 2 days later, the walls were coming out, and he was rearranging and adding a bathroom. And he's talking about how much he wants to get done, and I'm shaking my head. But then I watch him go, and he goes and goes and goes and goes and goes and goes and goes, and he's tired, and he goes some more. And I could say, son, why don't you just, like, you know, calm it down a little bit and slow that thing down. But I know that would be the wrong thing to do, because I know that if I try to hold him back a little bit and say, why don't you spread this out over 6 weeks instead of trying to get it done in 2.5, this bathroom project, he may not make it. Because he set his goal high, he may not reach it. But one thing's for sure, he's going to get it done a long time sooner than if he would just decide, you know, I've got until December the 29th. I'll just make it last that long. Well, guess what? The sink might not be hooked up, or the shower might not work yet. But because he set his goals high, and he's pressing for it, and he's pressing for it, he can miss that mark by a week or two and still be just fine. Set your goals high. Set your goals high. And that sounds a little discouraging, because then it says you may not have to reach the mark. That's not what I mean. I'm saying set the goals high and let it energize you to press towards the mark. Set them high. Number one, an orderly life. An orderly life. God is a God of order. Right? God is a God of order. There's nothing disorganized, nothing cluttered, nothing chaotic, nothing out of sync in anything God planned, or anything that God set in place, or anything that God commanded. Nothing. God put things in an orderly way. Remember what we shared about yesterday, just a little bit, about that consistent, dependable, predictable, repetitive life pattern? God understands that concept. And that's how He set everything in place. Everything. Everything He ever did. Little children thrive on that kind of a life. This consistent, dependable, predictable, repetitive life. Little children thrive on that. Older people do too. It's very restful. It's very secure. It's a place where we can trust. When God created, He set an order. Think about the universe. Somebody was just telling me a little bit ago, or in the last couple of days, the marvel of men of old who understood the stars. Oh, it was about those dear folks that were hostage in Haiti. How God put some people in that group who knew how to read the stars. And how maybe we're not so intelligent anymore because we have to use our app on our phone to figure out where even the North Star is. But these folks, some of them were studied up and knew how to read the stars. And men of history navigated all over this earth just because of the stars. And why? Because they were so orderly. God didn't mess it up every couple of days or every couple of weeks and just kind of keep that thing moving around. It was orderly in the universe, day and night. God said, this light is the day, this light is the night, and it is good, like we heard on day one here in the morning. It is good. It's orderly. This is daytime. This is nighttime. None of us ever go to bed at night and wonder, well, I wonder if tomorrow will be another day. We just know it will be. And when the day begins, we don't ever wonder, well, I wonder if this day is going to be a manageable length, or if it's going to go on so long like Joshua's day that one day that I just won't be able to make it through the day. We never wonder that. We know it's orderly. God is a God of order. Seasons, same way. Four seasons, seed time and harvest, they shall not fail as long as the earth lasts. God is a God of order. That's how He thinks. That's how He does. When He created animals and trees and all these things, He said, this is going to bring forth after its kind. So we don't plant a radish seed and have an oak tree grow out of it. It doesn't happen. We don't even worry about those kinds of things, do we? We never even think about that. And when we go out to see if the cow had a calf, we don't worry about, wonder whether it's going to be a dog or an elephant. It's going to be another cow. We know that. God is a God of order. It seems very simple, and yet somehow we miss this thing in our daily life or in application to ourselves and how we live. I'm amused by something in some of this reading on the impact of technology, and again, I can't even remember the name of the author of the book, but they've coined this phrase called the circadian rhythm. And that is just what I've been talking about. You get up, you do this a certain time of the day, you do and so forth. Your day is routine. Well, this thing of technology is interrupting that because now we get business calls anytime 24 hours a day, text messages 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Emails are going 24 hours a day. It's not unusual to get up and have messages that came at 1:30 a.m. and so forth. And if you happen to hear that, pretty hard to stay in bed if you happen to forget to turn the signal off. And I'm not saying you and me, I'm saying at society at large are jumping out, checking this thing up, and it's actually destroying us from the inside out. It is. And they're calling it and these men are suggesting that we do things with our technology to place them in certain times of the day. Now I will make my phone calls at this time of day. I will check my messages this time of day. I will respond and return to that circadian rhythm. That's what they're saying because it's messing us up. Well, I'm sitting here saying circadian rhythm, nothing. It's called God's order. That's how he designed it in the first place. You're supposed to go to bed when it gets dark. You're supposed to sleep all night. When that's over, you're supposed to get up and start another day and do things in a routine that's just God's order. Circadian rhythm, that sounds good because it'll create a really intelligent sounding conversation. But the fact is, it's just simply God's order. And that's the way God created it, and it's very good. It's consistent, dependable, predictable, and repetitive life patterns. When God chose a special people, the people of Israel, he began to give direction. It was orderly, very orderly. The organization of the camp, I studied up on that for a Bible study here recently. Amazing, amazing order. They all knew exactly where to go every time they moved camp. This is how we set it up. Tabernacle here, 3 tribes this way, 3 tribes this way, 3 tribes this way, 3 tribes this way. All of them, and if you look at their numbers, it's kind of interesting to think about what the size of that camp was and how that, if you lay it out the way I think it was laid out, it's going to look almost exactly like this cross that I had drawn up here. But anyway, that's a whole other story, and you can challenge me on that later on. But the organization of the camp, the fact of the matter is, it was predictable and repetitive. They knew exactly what to do. Nobody was concerned or confused or wondering. The schedule of their week, it was always there. They knew what the Sabbath day was, and they knew what they were supposed to do with it. The week's schedule was orderly. The schedule of the yearly feasts, they had that yearly feast thing going on. And I could just imagine these children looking forward to each one of those feasts as they came. Oh, that's the one where we have this kind of bread, and this is the one where we clean out all the leaven and all the good times that go around with those, and they could depend on it. It was predictable and repetitive. The methods of cleansing, the method and order of moving the camp. When it came time to move, it was this, 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 and they fall in. It was all very orderly, and it was dependable, and it was restful. You can think about the details of the tabernacle and the life of the priests and all of that, and think about the order that was there. This was God, and he says, this is how you do it. And he didn't do it because he wanted to just control this thing. He did it because people thrive on that thing. People thrive when things are orderly, in order, predictable, patterned, repetitive. I know what to expect. I don't have to be all churned up inside about this. Just orderly. Very orderly, and when followed, very restful. So, for us, very simple. This is a very simple message. Daily schedule. I'm not going to use circadian rhythm. I'm going to use God's order. God's order. Get up time. We could be so strict as to say it must be within a minute of the same time every. I don't mean that, but just the same time every morning. Get up. Meal times. Our children, I'm talking about children primarily and young people. Our children thrive on this. We do too, but we're responsible for it. Meal times, as much as possible, keep them at the same time of the day. It creates a restful environment. We don't have to wonder, are we going to eat together this meal? Yes or no? Are we going to have to scrounge in the fridge this time? Yes or no? No, meal times, family time. I'm not here to tell you when your family time should be, but you should have one. You should have some. It needs to be roughly the same every day, just as much as possible. Routine. God's a God of order, and he knows people thrive on that. When daddy leaves for work and when daddy comes home, and you go on with your own lives, so you plug in the pieces there, but it's the rhythm of the day. It's a rhythm. And I think there's a lot of humanity that lives in chaos and out of control. And there's even an element of promoting the idea that we should be more spontaneous and abstract. Oh, a spontaneous surprise is a pleasant thing. I would promote that. But largely, routine. And we're losing that in our day. We're losing that just because of all the easy entertainment, the easy access to information, and all the things that are the calls and the pulls and the tugs. But daily scheduling, keep it routine. Weekly schedule. This maybe is mostly moms because this is what came to my mind. But weekly schedule. It's okay to know that, in fact, our children do well to know that Mondays and Thursdays we do the laundry. That's when we do it. Mondays and Thursdays, we just know that. Baking on Wednesdays. Serving others on Tuesdays, the day that we go do that. Cleaning on Fridays. This is each week. Just looks a lot the same. It's restful. This is very simple. Yearly schedule. I'm a promoter of annual traditions. I'm unashamed of that. Children love to look forward to something. They know this is what we do this time of year. In our family, there's a certain time of year. It's winter time when there are various family gatherings. Scattered from about November through February or so, roughly. And it happens roughly about the same time every year. And so this November, my oldest sister comes in from Washington here in about 2 weeks. And every year at about the same time, our family gets together. And the children enjoy that. They can depend on it. They look forward to it. It brings rest and security to them to have something like that in their year to look forward to. It's a blessing. Tremendous. It's orderly. When all the orderly schedule has a godly purpose and zeal, it brings rest, it brings security, and it brings strength. That's how God is. Your schedule may not be the perfect one, but when it's consistent, predictable, dependable, and repetitive, it's good. It brings rest to the family. This is an expectation that we see in God's plan from the very beginning, that there be just a routine that can be followed. Children will thrive, and they'll respond better to you and to life, by the way. When they're thriving and they're restful, they will respond better to you. Now to you youth, for just one moment before we move on to the will problem. Start now. Some of you, many of you, not all of you, but some of you are old enough that your parents probably aren't going to set your alarm clocks for you or plan the pattern of your day for you or of your week. But start now. Schedule your life. Set the standard high. Set the habit early of having routine. For young people who aren't necessarily tied to a companion or tied to a house that needs all of the weekly care and so forth, it's going to take a choice. But if you can get that routine started now, this is when I get up, this is when I read my Bible, this is when I pray, this is, and be respectful, but promote the idea in your home. I'll be a supporter of a common meal time. I want to be there every time. I'll be a supporter of a common bedtime. I'll be there. And just commit your lives to a routine. Everything in culture and society today is against that, and it wants to pull it apart. But you will thrive, and so will your new home when the Lord gives you one. I want to move on now to the will problem. The order of the life is restful. It will produce an expected end in your home. The will problem. Does anybody else have this problem? It's called the self-will problem, actually. Nobody else? I do. Two of them. I only have one self, but it seems like there's more than one sometimes. The will problem. An understanding of this problem requires a desperate clinging to a long-term vision. We have to go back to the beginning to understand this problem and to be able to work with it, to be able to take a hold of it, to be willing to go to the extent that is needed to bring this will problem under control. It takes a dedication to that long-term vision, an absolute dedication, because everything it seems like out there is working against us when we try to do this. Our own wills work against us in this thing. We need to have that long-term vision. When working with the willfulness in our homes, we need to understand that we are patterning a heart for a lifetime and for a greater work. We're patterning a heart. Those little wills that are rising up in our children and those around in our home, if this is not taken care of, it's going to be a lifetime of challenge and problem. possibly devastation and heartache, possibly an eternal difference. So it's worthy of the investment. The purpose of working with wills isn't just to make life tolerable or to make our family look impressive. That's not the will. It's easy to think that, well, if I could just get my children to behave while we're at church, it would sure look better to everybody, and I could feel like I'm doing well. But that's actually not the purpose at all. It's a greater look than that. Self-will, as we all know, began one day in Isaiah 14. We talked about that the other day. We don't need to go there again, but it's Lucifer. Lucifer started this whole thing of self-will when he says, I will, I will, I will, I will, I will. He wanted to compete with God. And he took that to Adam and Eve, and their self-will rose up, and they had everything made. They had everything just as well and nice and good as it could possibly be. But the self-will said, but I want that one thing that God said I can't have. And that's what the self-will is always doing. Your home can be the most rhythmic place. It can be the most restful place. It can be a beautiful environment. You can have the best vision, and you can have everything there, but there might be one thing, and that's what that little child's heart's going to want. They're going to want that one thing, and that's how Lucifer's at work. It's self-will. Our child is that way too. So I want to, this afternoon, I want to again authorize you like I did the other day. I want to again give you the authority, fathers, young fathers, I want to give you the authority again to deal with this will in your child. I see almost an inferiority in many parents. I might have shared a little bit of that. It's been my heart here the last couple of days. It's been on my heart for some reason. An inferiority in many parents. In a world full of liberties and freedoms that people are taking, self-freedom, self-will, God's way seems too simple and too basic. And so there's an attempt to find other solutions, other methods, other ways, and psychologists are at work at it, and child psychology is working at it. And the whole social services world's got a different message for us than what we believe in. It's a world full of that, and God's way is almost too simple and too basic. And I see fathers a little bit inferior about this thing, a little bit insecure and uncertain about God's way. And I just want to reauthorize you. I hear parents give long and complicated explanations to very little children about why and what and how and when. And it almost ends up, some of these conversations almost end up in a spirit of apology for needing to deal with this child's will. And how confusing to a little child when God has it so simply laid out. I want to authorize you. I want to energize you. I want to excite you that the little will, these little wills, the way they're born is that little will wants to be like Lucifer's little will, or big will, I should say. It wants to be like Lucifer's will. That's how the nature of that child, that's how it is. I want to excite you and authorize you that you have the authority to do the Bible way of training your children and working on their self-will. We want to fight for it. We want to do diligence like Deuteronomy chapter 6. Let's turn to Proverbs real quick. Read a few verses. You knew I'd go to Proverbs, I'm sure, those of you who are thinking with me here this afternoon. Proverbs chapter 22. This is going to sound kind of brutal, brothers and sisters, I'm telling you. But this is what the Word of God says. It's what the Bible teaches us. I want to tell you that for generations it worked. I want to tell you that it will still work. It will still work. This is largely how I was trained. Not a lot of words. I think because my parents, my daddy wasn't that eloquent or that wordy. He probably had an advantage over some of us who like to talk more. And the communication was largely the way Proverbs teaches, and less with a whole bunch of explanation that could have been confusing as a little child. Proverbs 22, verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Verse 15, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. Familiar verses. You know these verses. Chapter 13. I've got to back up for that one. Chapter 13. Proverbs 13. Verse 24. He that spareth his rod hateth his son, but he that loveth him chasteneth him betimes. Chapter 19. Verse 18. Chasten thy son while there is hope, and let not thy soul spare for his crying. You let these words sink. I'm not going to make a lot of comments for time here. But let not thy soul spare for crying, for his crying. Chapter 23. Verse 13. Withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die. Chapter 29, this is the one I was headed for. Chapter 29, verse 15. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. One more verse, verse 17. Correct thy son, and he shall give thee rest. Yea, he shall give delight into thy soul. All of these sound pretty harsh. And I know that we all believe in spanking our children, but I wanted to point these out because they all lead to one thought, and that is in verse 15 of chapter 29. It says, the rod and reproof give wisdom. The rod and reproof. What gives wisdom? The rod and reproof. What gives wisdom? The rod and reproof. That's what the Bible says. This gives wisdom. The rod and reproof gives wisdom. I kind of pointed to this little idea yesterday or the day before, I'm not sure. It says, it's this way, we're after wisdom, right? That's what we want our children to have. And we could study on the topic of wisdom out of Proverbs and throughout the Scriptures for hours. Beautiful thoughts, too. It's a tremendous study. But knowledge and understanding come after obedience. Jesus himself taught that principle. He said, if you obey my words, then you will understand the doctrine. And so that's what we need our children to do. They need to obey. They need to obey. They need to obey. And did you know that obedience is wisdom? And did you know that if we read through the book of Proverbs, what is wisdom? Oftentimes, wisdom is the ability to withhold speaking too much. Oftentimes, wisdom is in silence. It's in a submissive spirit. It's in serving. You look at the attributes of wisdom in Proverbs. It's a lot of things that we can teach our children to do. Knowledge is why that's better and why that works. As we get older, we start to understand and knowledge begins to come. Oh, that's why, that's why, that's why. And those of us who are older, who've exercised ourselves, we understand that. But a child isn't ready to grasp all that. But they can be wise. And he says, rod and reproof gives wisdom. We need to exercise that. We need to exercise it. These children need to understand that when there is a will, self-will, that's exercised, it's self-will. And sometimes it's a little hard to discern when it's self-will and it's other things. I'm gracious enough to acknowledge that. But when there is self-will, the way to deal with self-will is the rod and reproof. The rod and reproof give wisdom. Brother John Byers, I think it was, is the one who helped me understand this a little bit. He says this, that from the ages of 0 to 12 years old, roughly, 12-ish, everybody's children are a little bit different, from the ages of 0 to 12, children ought to be taught to obey without understanding. And I could tell all the stories about little children who were in dangerous positions and dad uttered one word, they obeyed instantly and it saved their life. And there's some dramatic stories, real life stories out there. You've probably read and heard those. But that's an example of why they need to do, just like what Brother Mick was promoting here the other day when he was witnessing for his brother. And the little child, yes, Dad. Not, why, Dad? I don't understand, Dad. Tell me why, and then I will. No, it's, son, go. Yes, Dad. And it saved children's lives. And it will save our children's life in the long run. And there's an eternal reason for this. There is an eternal reason for this. They're getting prepared for something bigger. It's not about just having a controlled environment at home. It's something bigger. Child's self-will. Listen to this one. A child's self-will will not be broken with lots of explanations, ideals, and philosophy. A child's self-will won't learn that way. A child's self-will will learn with a barrier that is unmovable and with consequences that are undesirable. That's the Proverbs. That's the Scripture way. That's how a will is exercised. After 12, there's some beautiful things that can happen if we get their will before they're 12. I'm using 12 as a round number, you understand that. After 12, and I plan to talk about that tomorrow, I love talking about the relationships and the communication and so forth of the older ages and the future generations. But until 12, if we don't get that one, if we can't get that one about right, we're going to struggle in our relationships with them after that, as they're older. Just remember that. If you have more questions about that, I'm happy to talk about these themes with you in private. After 12 will be wonderful if we can get their will before 12. The goal is far greater. The largest part of life and purpose is after 12. That's a teeny tiny little fragment of life, but it's a very important one. Self-will is going to have a tremendous part in our effectiveness for a lifetime. Think about how self-will affects marriages. Think about it. And if the child has not been taught how to eliminate that self-will. And it comes in Christ, and it comes in conversion. I understand that. But we provide a tremendous opportunity for them if we help them with that before they're 12. Marriage, in church, when you want to walk together with a brotherhood, what happens when we have self-will? And you have self-will, and I have self-will, or everybody, nobody does but me, then what happens? You understand what happens there, self-will. The testimony of the church is tainted. Youth, I'm sorry that was so quick, but you get the point. Self-will is one of curbing the self-will is one of the expectations that come from a godly home. And there may be, again, I don't want to lock it into one or two ways, but the Bible way will work. The Bible way will work. And I would say, let's get the children's self-will, that expectation for the future. Youth, get help with your self-will. Your parents aren't, you're older than 12. Every one of you sitting in these front rows is older than 12 years old now. And you can't just say, Dad, I think I still have self-will. And so why don't we go out behind the barn and you bring the rod and I'll come along with you and we'll get this thing out of here. It's not that way anymore for you. You don't have that opportunity. It's too bad. I'm sorry about that, but that won't work anymore. But now you can make some choices on your own, and you can still ask for help. We have a young lady. I have a young lady that comes to my wife and I about every 2 months, roughly, probably. She sits down there in her office, and she says, I just want to open up my life to you. Is there anything? Is there anything that you see? Is there anything you can help me with? I just want to stay. I just want to stay connected with the vision of the church, with you as ministry. I just want to stay accountable in my life, in my behavior, attitude towards my parents. And she just opens up her life. It's a tremendous blessing, and you can do that, and I would recommend that. And she's been committed to that faithfully, roughly every 2 months. If somebody's not faithful, it's usually our schedule. But you can do that. You want to be effective in the kingdom of heaven, and you want to be one of those servants that blesses, and you want to be one of those builders in the church, and one of those supporters that helps things move forward smoothly and beautifully and testifies of the love of Jesus in your church. I'm sure that the ministry here would just be delighted if you would say, could I set up an appointment roughly every 2 months or even whatever schedule you want. Help me with my self-will. Help me with my attitudes. Help me with my relationships. Help me in my walk with God. I just want to open up my life to you. It's a tremendous opportunity that you have in your stage of life. I'd recommend it. The reason for rules, I don't have much time for this one, but and maybe I shouldn't even pull these object lessons out. I have up here two things. I have this mouse trap, and I'm going to go ahead and set this mouse trap real quick. I don't think this one will take real long to make my point. But the reason for rules, rules in the household, rules, expected behavior in the household set by rules is an expectation in a godly home. It just is. It's there. Quick and simple. There's two reasons. Reasons for rules. One of those is sin, and the other one is relationships. The first one's sin. I have this mousetrap here. In my mind, sin equals danger. Sin equals danger. The reason for rules, one of the reasons for rules is danger. Could I get one of you young men to volunteer to come up here and put your finger on that little cheese trigger? Any volunteers? Just put your finger right there on that. You'd do it? All right. No. Wait a minute. I got to warn you, Nathaniel. No. That's dangerous. That's going to hurt. You know it's going to hurt? And I don't know how strong your finger is, but it could actually break your finger. I think it could. Probably not yours. That's dangerous. So what we got right here now is I'm just going to go ahead. If you don't mind, I'm just going to go ahead and make a rule. Don't play with mouse traps. Okay? Can we agree on that? Yeah, okay, good. All right. Well, life is filled with things like that are dangerous. There's a place in Kentucky over east called Red River Gorge. Many of you have probably been there. But my family and I like to go there, and we're always astonished when we go because there's hardly any guardrails in that place, and there's drop-offs that are hundreds of feet, and there's not even any danger signs really at those cliffs. It's amazing. And we like going there for that reason, but it's a little bit astonishing. And there ought to be, so there is some little rule signs that say different things, but it's dangerous. And it's fine to say, do not go to the edge of the cliff. That's dangerous. That's a rule. Danger. And sin is dangerous, brothers and sisters and young people. Sin is dangerous. And I'll just show you what happens. If your finger was in there, it would be very, very painful. You'll know that. That's a very simple illustration. But it's okay to decide that we're not going to do that because it's dangerous. And so we don't sin because it's dangerous. Most people get this one. Thou shalt not kill, right? Why? Because it's sin. And there's lots of other reasons. It takes someone's life. It's, you know, all those things. But it's sin. It's danger. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Dangerous. And we could go on down through those lists. Sin is dangerous. Most people get this one. Sin equals death. And so it's all right. Though I do need to mention this one. Somehow in light of the godly home, the godly values, the godly vision of a godly family, I thought of this just briefly as I thought about sin and rules about that. The opposite of godly is worldly. To not be godly, godly is godlike. And so if we're not going to be like God, there's only one thing left in our realm, and that is like the world. And so that's, there it is, and that is sin. If you read 1 John chapter 2, 15 and 16, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. And you know the quote better than I do. You get my point. It's worldly. And rules help identify sin and save from death. Thou shalt not kill. If nobody ever told us that, we might not even know. But we know that the Bible says not to do that, and it's okay to do that. So I hope we clearly teach that principle in our godly homes. It's an expectation. It's okay to have things set in place that say, don't play with a mousetrap, because you're going to die if you do. That exposes it. That's one reason. The second reason is relationships. I want to read one verse to you here, and that's in 1 John chapter 3. One verse. The second reason for rules is relationships. And this one here, people stumble over a little bit more for some reason. And I don't know that it matters what we call them. The term rules, even that very word, puts a lot of people off. I'm not sure why. But it doesn't have to be called rules. It can be called principles. It can be called agreements. It can be called any word you want to put there. But the principle remains the same if two people are going to walk together. Here in 1 John 3:16. Hereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. There's another reason. We ought to lay down our lives for the brethren, because Jesus did for us. All right? So now we're in our homes. And this is a Dutch Blitz game. Am I saying that right? I was sure I was going to call it the wrong game name, because I don't play the game. How many of you know what Dutch Blitz is? You ever played Dutch Blitz? So most of you have, probably by raising your hands. That's Dutch Blitz. You know how to play the game? Well, why do you know how to play the game? Well, because there's some rules, right? And so if we all decide we wanted to play Dutch Blitz, and I don't know how to play, I really don't know how to play Dutch Blitz. And you ask me to play, and maybe is there anybody else here who doesn't know how to play? Okay, and Albert over here, and this sister here, and Dan. Okay, the four of us are going to play Dutch Blitz. But we don't know how to play Dutch Blitz. And so we just decide to go at it, whatever. And so I decide, well, I'm going to put a card here and here. And I don't know what to do with these cards. Maybe you just throw them up in the air. I don't know what you do with them. And each one decides to do whatever they want to do. How's that going to come out? It doesn't work. But we love each other. The four of us, we do. And we live in the same home. And we want to do this together. And so we say, well, to play Dutch Blitz, this is what you do. You get each so many cards. You deal those cards out. And then whatever the rules are from there. Now we can play it and we can have a pleasant time. We know how to start. We know how it ends. We know how to do it. It's how we do in our homes. And go back to the circadian rhythm thing, the order of God. And in our homes, there is nothing sin or not sin about some of the things we agree to do in our homes. But we do it because it helps us walk together in a beautiful, blessed relationship. And we couldn't do it otherwise. It's a lot like a walk in the woods for a couple people decide to take a walk. And we want to do it to my wife and I. We love each other, so we're going to take a walk. In fact, we did that this afternoon. We took a walk around the property. And, well, we want to be together. And nothing's going to tear us apart. We want to be together. But I kind of wanted to walk that way around the property, and she kind of wanted to walk this way around the property. And I actually just wanted to walk out to the road and back, but she wanted to do the whole, I'm making some of this up, but she wanted to do the whole loop. Well, so somehow we had to decide when and where and how and why we're going on this walk together. Simple, very, very simple, but for the sake of relationships, we decided together how to do it. It took very little communication for us, almost none, in fact, because that's how it gets when you walk together long enough with that kind of unity. And it will work in a brotherhood too, by the way, but this is our homes now. This is how it comes. And so it's okay to decide that in our home, this is what we do in certain things. Now that my illustrations are slipping away from me, Brother Mick. But it's okay to decide what time we're going to have breakfast. It's fine to do that. It's actually even okay to say that in our home, this is probably the kind of parameters we want to do in our clothing. It's okay. We can do that. May not be exactly like yours, but it's okay in our home. And we've got to decide something. And so we do that together. And that's, you call them rules, call them agreements, call them principles, call them whatever you want, but there's a reason for it, because it helps keep people together. And everywhere you have two people, you're going to have two different ideas. And so we're preparing these children for something greater, right? We're preparing them for something far bigger and longer lasting and of a bigger purpose than those four walls called our house. That's what we're preparing. We're preparing a paradigm in their mentality for something greater, something later. Just like the Dutch Blitz game. Wow. Yes. That's the second reason. An orderly life enters into this. How are we going to have an orderly life together? The self-will is a huge part of this. How are we going to do this? Well, 1 John says we ought to lay down our lives. That's how it works. That's the only way it works. It's patterning for a greater work. There comes a time when our children will walk in brotherhood, just like we walk in brotherhood. They will. Lord willing, they're going to walk with Jesus, and they're going to find a brotherhood in Christ to walk together with. In order to walk together in harmony and relationship, there will be agreements. There's no group of people who ever stayed together that doesn't have some agreement. It just doesn't work. The Bible says it very plainly. It says, how can two walk together except to be agreed, right? Very plain, simple. It's right out of the Word of God. It's a rhetorical question. It's a self-answering question. It doesn't happen. You have to agree or you won't walk together. It's that simple. And so these children are going to be doing that in a godly brotherhood. So how can we help them do that today? Children, and they'll come to you and they'll say, but Dad, Johnny over in that family, he doesn't have to do that, or they don't do it that way. And you can say, it's okay. I authorize you, brothers. This is our home. This is the orderly way we're walking together. Son, that's okay. In our home, we do it this way. Ooh, goes against my self-will. It hurts. That sounds like a rule. That feels restrictive. No, it's orderly, and it helps us to walk together in good relationships. It's called laying down our lives for one another. It's not scary. It's not dangerous. It exercises every part of us that Jesus said needs to be crucified. And that's one of the reasons for all this, by the way. This is some of the expectations that need to come out of godly homes. They've been lost in many modern homes today. The idea of self-will, we can almost not identify what it is anymore. There's a lot of sympathy for our own selves and our own flesh, and therefore for our own children and their flesh, and for others and their flesh. A lot of sympathy there for all of that. It's really hard to identify that whole self-will sometimes with the things that face us every day. The orderly life, we have to fight for it, brothers. There's things pulling us every direction. There's things that want to just tear apart that thing. And obviously the laying down lives for one another, this is an independent world, brothers, sisters. This is a world where everybody wants to live for themselves. Everybody wants to do their own thing. And then we find righteous and godly reasons to defend ourselves in doing that. Lord, help us. All that needs to be crucified. We need to put ourselves on that cross, like we talked last night. This needs to go away. And the home, the godly home, is the opportunity that's lost so much momentum in recent years, but it is the perfect environment. It is the opportunity. It is the place where for a few short years we can create a paradigm and a perspective in our children's lives to live orderly, to lay down their wills, and to be okay with walking together in relationships, though there's some agreement there. It's a tremendous opportunity to produce that paradigm and that perspective in their hearts. We only have a brief moment to do it. So homes motivated by an eternal purpose have a godly environment and can be expected to produce godly elements, orderly lives, crucified self-wills, and appreciation for laying down our lives for a brotherhood agreement. Young people, invest yourselves in these ideals. Won't be long. You'll be able to exercise them in homes of your own.